was speaking to some college students last Friday night, and then yesterday for a couple of sessions. Then my wife and I actually have a parenting session this afternoon that we're doing. So if I all of a sudden start talking about romance and dating from a Christian perspective, or jumping about how to listen to your kids, please forgive me. We'll get back on track a little bit with our passage, but there's a couple of different messages that are floating around in my head, so to speak. But it is really fun to be with you here. I don't know if any of you are like me, but I hate waiting. Does anybody hate waiting? I mean, I just hate waiting. I remember the first time we took our kids to Disneyland. You know, once you get over the initial, like, wow, this costs $3,000 just to go to Disneyland. We just did the whole thing wrong. You know, we showed up at noon, you know, instead of like when the park opens. And I forgot the camera, and so me being just like this OCD dad said, no, we can't have our kids go to Disneyland the first time and not have a camera. So we go all the way back to where we're staying to get the camera. That's why we got there at noon. You know, we had to work that spousal argument out a little bit later. But we spent the whole day with our kids and didn't go on a single ride. So the next time we went to Disneyland, I said, I am not doing it that way again. There's just no way. I heard about this magical program called Ride Max. And I don't know if you've heard about it. It was unbelievable. And what it is, apparently, is this, they sell you on the concept that someone has put together an algorithm that helps you understand the flow of traffic at Disneyland. And what's crazy about it is somehow they get access to the numbers of who's in the park and what rides, because you have all these, you know, things that you click and slide and whatever else. So what you can do is you can go in the night before and you say, hey, this is what we want to do. We want to go into the park about this time. These are the rides we want to see. We want to come out for lunch, get the kids a nap. We want to come back in about this time. We want to leave the park about this time. And it just goes, and, you know, spits this thing out. Now, I had a laptop at the time that I was borrowing that had, like, it was like a 9600 baud rate kind of, you know, it was just super slow, like, So I had to sit in the lobby to download this thing, like where we're staying. I'm sitting in the lobby to download this program, waiting forever. And then I finally punched in our coordinates, and it spit out this beautiful list of how to see the park. And, man, we saw everything. It was awesome. We've got the fast pass at the right time. And what's amazing about Disneyland, if you haven't been there, you come upon these signs that are really daunting. Like, if you want to see the Matterhorn, and you're standing in line, you think, oh, okay. Disney does a great job of hiding the lines. You don't know how big these things are. And then all of a sudden you come upon a sign that says, 3 days from here. You know, it's like, what? You know? You see people like knitting an Afghan thing, you know, they're like making a sweater because they got time. Somebody's got a box of books that they're reading because, you know, they're going to be there for a while. I think I saw one guy with an old El Camino transmission. He's just working on the thing, just kind of sliding along. It's like, And so with this deal, you get to kind of slide right through. You get these fast passes, and you feel like this VIP, and you walk past all these lines of people who have stare with daggers at you, and you get right up to the front of the line. So Ride Max is a great program that has just kind of eliminated waiting at Disneyland, because waiting is just tough. I don't like waiting. I hate waiting. And what's interesting about the passage we're going to look at today is there's some waiting that has to happen. There's some patience that Peter and others are going to need to develop. And I would say even for us, that God is saying that you need to be a little patient before you get home. I want us to look at the passage. We're in John chapter 13. And just to set the context, we're going to be looking at 13:36 through chapter 14, verse 3. But the context of what's going on here is they're having these conversations in the upper room, and there's a number of things that they've been discussing. One of the things that was discussed in verse 33 is that Jesus tells his disciples that he's going to only be with them for a little while longer, then he's going to be gone. They're going to seek him, but he told the Jews, where I'm going, you cannot come. And then he follows that up with probably the most foundational statement and commandment of the Christian faith about the idea to love one another. Just lays this incredibly beautiful commandment that's really powerful, really tricky, really hard to love like Christ. And where we land in our passage, and I want to kind of just read us verse by verse as we go. I won't read it all at the beginning. But right on the heels of that, Peter has a question. Look with me at verse 36 of chapter 13. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? Jesus answered, where I go, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow me later. You know what's so interesting about this is that Peter doesn't even ponder this great statement that Jesus just mentioned about love. He doesn't ask for clarification. He doesn't wonder at the complexity of it. He's not humbled by the magnitude of it. All he wants to know is, where are you going? It's like, did I miss the memo? You know, did I miss the disciples meeting that said you're leaving somewhere? How come I didn't hear this? And what's interesting in the context is he's already been saying to the Jews this kind of idea that where I'm going, you can't follow. And now he's saying to his men, I'm going somewhere. I'm leaving you. And so Peter's like confused. He's intrigued. He's like, what is going on here? Have you ever had that situation where you try to say something to somebody and they don't even hear what you're saying? Because they're so focused on their response. Like if you're in an argument, maybe you've had an argument with your spouse, and all you're trying to do is get that response ready in your head, you know that? Oh man, I'm just going to just wait for that pause, and I'm just going to step in and destroy them. Well, maybe you don't do that. I do that sometimes. But Peter's not even hearing what's going on. All he hears is this idea is that I am no longer going to be with you, and it stops everything for him. It makes him stop, and what do you mean you're no longer going to be here with us? It's not a simple inquiry. He's now confused. Look at Jesus' response. Jesus says, where I go, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow me later. And what's interesting about the idea of the word follow here, it's not like the idea of behind me, like in sequence. It's more the idea of accompany me. It's that you can't accompany me right now. It's not like you're not going to follow behind me. You're not going to get to go with me right now. It's kind of interesting about that idea. What it makes me think of is this. Have you ever been in a situation where someone asks you to follow them in their car? And so you're like, oh, great, how do I do this? You know, you feel like you're on the police episodes where should I stay 2-3 car lengths behind or I get right behind them? We had this situation where we were leading a group of students in Washington, D.C., and Janet and I, and we were coming back from Philadelphia. And I said, look, just follow me. I got this car, follow me. And so we were coming from Philadelphia, and if you don't know that part of the country, when you come down to Washington, D.C., there's a freeway called the 495, and the 495 is a circle. So depending on where you want to end up on the circle depends on where you start the top of the circle. And so we were trying to get to this part of the circle, and instead of taking the shortest route this way on 495, I took the longest route this way on 495. And that's when Janet was like going, I don't want to follow you. I want to be in the car and tell you where you're going. The idea that Jesus is saying is that you cannot accompany me right now. You can't go with me, be with me as I travel on this. And what's interesting is what he's talking about is he's talking about the timing. He's not talking about whether Peter can go. He's talking about when and the timing. And he's saying, Peter, you can't do that right now. What's interesting is Peter doesn't really hear the phrase, you will follow later. He doesn't hear that. Actually, that comes in a second. But yeah, he says it right now. He says, you can't follow me, but you will follow me later. And Peter, it's like that just totally goes past Peter. He doesn't hear that you will follow me later. He wants to know, why can't he come right now? And it's interesting when you look at how this was written, he's really saying, why? Because why? There's an emphasis on this idea that why can I not go with you right now? Have you ever been around kids who want something and they don't get it and they want to know why? You know, Peter's not like a little kid here, but there's the agitation behind his words that says, why can't I go with you? Why? I want to be with you. Why can't I go? I mean, that's where he kind of throws out this concept in the next verse. Look at verse 37. It says, Lord, why can I not follow you right now? I will lay down my life for you. So it's kind of interesting. Like Peter's almost trying to justify why he should get to go, right? Why can't I go with you? I'll lay down my life for you. I deserve to go with you. I think that's one way you can kind of look at it. Like, hey, I deserve to be able to go with you. Why can't I go with you right now? But I really don't think that's exactly the meaning behind why Peter's throwing this out there. Flip back a few chapters with me to John chapter 6. One of the things that was interesting when Jesus was talking about the bread of life discourse and they had a long conversation with people, and the way it ended was a lot of people didn't like what he had to say. In verse 66 of John chapter 6, it says, as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. So Jesus said to the 12, you do not want to go away also, do you? Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to whom shall we go? you have the words of eternal life. We have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God. You see, I think what was behind Peter's comment, his pleading, his boasting that I will give my life for you, is not so much his pride as it is loyalty. That I will do anything for you. Please take me with you. I want to do anything for you. The thought of Jesus leaving him made him really, really anxious and really sad, to the point that he was going to make this promise that there is going to be a really hard thing for him to keep. You know, Peter kind of pictured himself in his best self, like, wow, what's the best thing that I could do for Jesus? How could I show him that I'm really loyal to him? And he says, I'll even die for you. And he throws out this huge promise, this idea of what I would do for you to show you how loyal I am. Well, Jesus answers in verse 38. He says, will you lay down your life for me? Truly, truly, I say to you, a rooster will not crow until you deny me three times. It's interesting how Jesus doesn't answer the question. The question is, why can't I come with you? Jesus doesn't answer that. But what he does is he challenges Peter's bold claim. It's like, are you really going to follow through with that, Peter? Do you really mean that, Peter? Are you really that loyal, Peter? That's what he's asking. And then he talks about this idea. Now, the thing is, at the end of Peter's life, he does all of these things. And Jesus knows that. Jesus knows how loyal he is. But he knows that the beginning is going to be really tough for Peter. He sees what's going to happen in Peter's life. He sees the promise that Peter's made. He sees how much Peter wants to please him and follow him and do the right thing. And he knows exactly what's going to happen to Peter. That Peter is not going to live up to his promises. That he's not going to be the guy that he hoped he would be. And Jesus knows that. And Jesus sees that. See, Peter's vision of his loyalty and bravery is something that Jesus saw right through. He saw what was going to happen. And what's amazing about that is that as Jesus understands that, Jesus doesn't pull away from him. He doesn't withdraw the promise. What did he say earlier to Peter? He said, Peter, you're going to follow me. You will come. You will come later. That's in the bag, buddy. You've got that. You'll come later. He doesn't say, well, you're going to do something in a little bit that's going to make me pull back that invitation. You don't get to go. But see, Jesus knows exactly how Peter's going to fail. And he still says, I'm going to bring you with me. You get to follow me. Because Peter, it's not based on what you're going to bring. It's not based on your big promise. It's not based on what you can do. It's based on my grace. It's based on my mercy. Peter's saying, I'll show you. And Jesus is saying, Peter, you don't need to. Because it's my grace that's going to bring you with me. It's not your performance. It's not your ability to live out that promise that you made. It's not that thing that you're going to bring to the party. You see, he sees Peter in his worst self, his worst presentation of himself, and he still says, I want you. You're still going to come with me. Now, what's really interesting about this situation is that there's some other people listening in. The disciples are kind of watching this and kind of listening to this. And it's interesting to think about the emotional intensity of what's going on here. You know, Peter, it seems, is agitated about why don't we get to go? Why can't I follow you? I'll give my life to you. And everybody's like going, wow, man, that's pretty huge. And then Jesus right on the heel says, no, you won't. You're going to deny me. And what's interesting about what he says is that you're going to do the exact opposite of what you promised, Peter. You're going to deny you even know me. And you're not going to just do it once. You're going to do it three times. And the disciples are listening to this going, what the smoke is going on here, you know? Peter thinks he's this. Jesus saying, no, you're like this. And they're like going, hey, we thought Peter was the leader. And if he does that, what's going to happen to us? And Jesus is going somewhere. Where's he going? We can't go now. There's a lot of thickness in this moment. There's a lot of emotional turmoil, I think, that's going on because there's some unanswered questions. There's some bold statements and promises. There's some promise of failure that's on the horizon. Well, what does Jesus say in verse 14, chapter 14, verse 1? He says, he notices the moment. He feels the heaviness. He understands the conflict that Peter's got to be feeling, that the disciples have to be feeling. He understands the moment of what's going on. And he says this, do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God.
believe also in me. You see, after laying this huge bomb on Peter and everybody, he moves in to comfort their hearts about his leaving. This is what's so fascinating to me about Jesus. He's got truth and he's got grace. Here he just told Peter some truth that's really, really hurtful. That's going to really be hard. But then he comes right back around and says, Peter, I'm going to help you. I want to comfort you. And it's interesting that what's going on with this word about the idea of troubled. Let me just read some phrases that define it a little bit. The idea behind this word troubled really means to put into motion, to agitate something back and forth, to shake it to and fro like this. And it's also the idea that what we're setting into motion is something that really needs to remain calm. It's like this is something you don't want to shake back and forth. You know, imagine that vial of nitroglycerin that you have in your house. You know, that's not the kind of thing you want to shake back and forth and run all over the place. That what's being agitated is something that shouldn't be agitated. It should remain calm. It should remain still. That is our hearts. Because this shaking, this agitation causes this inward commotion. It takes away our calmness of mind. It gets us stirred up on the inside. And what's really interesting is the kind of word that he's using here. I'm going to get a little geeky here. There's a thing called a middle and a passive voice about how this word's used. And the idea behind that is it's a kind of word that is something we can do to ourselves. But it's also something that someone else can do to us. So, for example, when you're a kid, you would bathe your children. It's like, hey, mommy's going to give you a bath. That's something you receive, right? You receive that bath as a little kid. But as you get older, you bathe yourself. It's something you do to yourself. And Jesus is saying in this word is don't let these outside things act upon you and agitate you and trouble you. But at the same time, don't let those things that are agitating you cause you to keep spinning and bouncing it back and forth where you're rehearsing and rehearsing and rehearsing and you just keep troubling yourself over and over and over and over again. He said, don't let that happen. You ever get stuck in those vicious cycles where thought enters your head and it kind of bounces around for a while and it keeps kind of bouncing around for a while and it keeps snowballing and escalating and it gets bigger and bigger. It's kind of like that avalanche, you know, that little snow that starts falling and then it rolls into this huge hill or down the hill, this big ball. That's kind of this idea. We've had another one of those lately, some of you know, but our daughter Lauren has had a pituitary tumor in her life and she had it operated and taken out when she was a freshman. It came back when she was a junior, and now we saw that there's something there again. And it's so interesting because our daughter is kind of like, she sees this as an annoyance. It's like, oh, man, I can't believe it. Brain surgery again. Golly, you know. Which is really weird because she gets anxious about some of the silliest things, I think. But I do too. But it's the idea that mom and dad are agitated by this. Because this is news that hit us from the outside, and now it's in our heads. And now it's bouncing around inside of our heads. And it's causing us to be weighed down. And Jesus sees that in his disciples. He said, your hearts are troubled by this news of my leaving. And you're allowing that to just rattle in your heads. And he gives them a solution. He says, this is what you need to do. What you need to do is you need to believe in God and believe also in me. It's interesting. It's almost as Jesus is saying, you can, on some level, control the level of agitation you're going to experience. It's where you put your mental energy. What are you going to focus on? Are you focusing on the thing that's negative, that's going to hurt you? Or are you going to focus on something else? There's a choice that we have as a Christian. Are we going to listen to the fears? Are we going to listen to the accusations? Are we going to listen to the doubts? Or are we going to do what Jesus says? And what he says here, he says to believe. And it's a really interesting word because it's got this idea of persuasion. It's not just, okay, believe that the sky is blue, check that off. It's this idea of persuading yourself. It's the idea of believing. And it's in a tense that says, keep on believing. Continue to keep believing. That when you feel this trouble, when you feel this anxiety, keep on believing in God and in me and what I've told you and the promises I've told you. And even the idea of believing in God, it's not like just believe that he exists, but it's this idea to come into, to enter into. It's involved this almost a sense of like the penetration into a world for a certain purpose or result. So it's almost like he's saying, enter into the understanding of who God is. Enter into God's world. See yourself the way God sees you, as cherished, as loved, as a place that's reserved for you. Work on that stuff. You see, he's trying to orient them now in a different direction now that this bomb has gone off. And where it starts is it starts by believing the right things and believing in the right direction and staying with that and not letting that go. Second verse. Now we're getting to the answer of Peter's question. Jesus said, "In my Father's house are many dwelling places, and if it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you." I was reading a story the other day about a guy that was off to prepare a place for his wife. They were in Minnesota. It's a little cold in Minnesota, especially this time of the year. And he wanted to go and kind of get them out of the cold weather. And so I said, hey, let's go down to Florida. Let's go to the hotel we spent our honeymoon at. It'll be kind of fun. We'll get out of the cold weather. The way it works is that they couldn't kind of coordinate their schedules in the right time. So he flew down first. And then she was going to follow the next day. So he gets to the hotel, checks in, and there have been all these upgrades. They now have computers in the room and email. So he decides that he's going to write his wife an email, you know, to let him know that he's there and everything. So he writes out the email to her, but when in the email address, he misses her address by one letter. So what happens simultaneously when he hits the send, there's this woman who is coming back, and she's actually come back from a funeral of saying goodbye to her husband. And she goes in and basically reads the email and falls on the floor. And the guy, it's kind of a son, walks in, and he says, looks at what's going on to the email, and this is what the email said. "To my loving wife, subject, I've arrived. I know you're surprised to hear from me. They have computers here now, and you are allowed to send emails to your loved ones. I've just arrived and have been checked in. I see that everything has been prepared for your arrival tomorrow. Looking forward to seeing you then. Hope your journey is an eventful, uneventful as mine was. P.S. Sure is hot down here." So obviously that wasn't a real email, but what Jesus is saying to his disciples is that this is where I'm going. And it is such a powerful promise and a powerful picture that he says to his disciples about where he's going in verse 2. He says, "In my Father's house are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you." I just want to look at this phrase, "in my Father's house." You know, this idea of this house is this idea that it's not something that's empty. This is an inhabited place. It's a place where a family lives. It's a place where provisions are. And it's his Father's. He says, "I'm going to prepare a place for you in my Father's house. Are many dwelling places." It's a present tense. It's not like, hey, I got to go build this thing. Give me a few millennia to go build it. It's like, no, right now there is a place called my Father's house, and I'm going to go there. And it's got many dwelling places in it. And the idea behind this concept of a dwelling place is a place where you will make residence. It's a place that you will live. It's not a transitory place. It's not a way station. There's some other faiths that teach that there's kind of a way station that we get to after we die. And that's not Jesus' promise. He says, "You're coming to my Father's house." It's not a transitory place. It is a place to make up your residence. And there's a lot of places there. It's many dwelling places. You know, what's interesting is that it's such an intimate picture of what heaven is like. It's my Father's house. Now, I don't know when you daydream about heaven sometimes, but there's sometimes I think of heaven as like a resort. Like it's this big, beautiful place. There's just all these nice things to do there. There's all these beautiful rooms and all that stuff. This is not what it is. This is not some Airbnb that you just kind of get the code and punch the numbers in and you go into an empty place. This is a place where God the Father is. This is a place where he lives. And he said, "I want you to come to my dad's house. We're going to hang out at my dad's house." It's this beautiful, intimate thing. It's not some impersonal place. And what's interesting, the emphasis is not even on what's going on there. The quality of the rooms, the size of the rooms, the nothing. The emphasis is, this is my Father's house. And I want you to come and be with me in my Father's house. He goes on to say that I go to prepare a place for you. And this idea of going is that it kind of emphasizes a personal meaning to it. The idea of reaching a particular destination. You know, think about if you were to say to the word, you're at a dinner party with some friends and it's time to go home, you say, I'm going to go. That doesn't mean that much. But if you tell your friends, hey, I'm going to go to Paris tomorrow, there's a whole different idea, isn't it? This is idea that you're going to a really amazing place. There's some preparation, there's some personal, there's a focus there. And that's the word that's being used here. I'm going to a particular place. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to prepare it for you. I'm going to make the right preparations for you to get things right. I don't know what your house is like when company's coming over, but when company comes over to our house, it's like an all hands on deck cleaning thing, you know? It's like we want everyone to think that our house looks like this all the time. You know, we want to, this is a Pottery Barn house. We put all this stuff away. But, you know, if you were to arrive about 30 minutes early, you're going to see a mad flurry of Burns activity of trying to get this thing prepared to look nice. Now, Jesus isn't cleaning up heaven. That's not the idea. But the idea of intentionality, the idea of making something ready for an arrival, that's what's involved here. There's the intentionality of he's preparing this place so that when we come, we get to be there with him. It's kind of weird to think a little bit, isn't it? That, I mean, Jesus has been gone for some time. That's a whole lot of preparation that's going on, it seems. Kind of, it's interesting to daydream what that's like. I just had to be honest with you. Sometimes I get overwhelmed. I get overwhelmed to try to get my head around it, about what heaven is really like. There's a book out now called Heaven by Randy Alcorn that I've glanced at. It's a phenomenal book. Gets into some great layers that we can't get into. But what's interesting to me about the context of what is being said here is Jesus is really not talking about what the details of the place are. And so my mind starts to race about what it looks like and what it's going to be like and all the things you get to do. And then I start thinking, well, gosh, what did the first century people think about heaven? That'd be kind of an interesting thing. Like if Paul showed up today at our house, wouldn't that be interesting if someone from the first century showed up in our house and were saying, hey, Paul, how was your trip? How did I get here? I got in this big, long thing. Yeah, it's called a plane. Got here in about 2 hours. Two hours, really. Yeah. Do you have to use the bathroom? What's a bathroom? Well, it's this room that, you know, when you have to, well, just, yeah, use this thing. You just sit on that thing and it's just like, well, where's the smell? Well, there isn't one. Well, what is this place? You know, it's like, what's going on here? Do you need something to eat? Sure. Well, just open that big box. It's called a refrigerator. What's in it? Food. Where'd you get the food? Why did we get it at the store? What store? What's the store? You mean food just magically appears? I mean, there's some things that go on in our life that are so, to some people, heaven-like because of its ease, because of its comfort. Well, heaven's so much more than anything like that. I mean, we can't even fathom what it's like. The songs we did today were just beautiful that we did. It's this place of no suffering. It's this place of constant fellowship with Jesus. With each other. It's a beautiful place. I mean, the times that I get caught up on how beautiful this earth is, and then I think, what in the world will heaven be like with God putting so much detail and attention to this place, which is phenomenal? What in the world is heaven going to be like? Well, Jesus says, I'm going there to prepare it for you. And the emphasis, again, is not what he's building or what it's going to look like. The emphasis is that you get to be here, that I want you to be with me while we're here. That's why he says in the last verse, verse 3, if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. See, this is the second time now Jesus is reassuring, I'm going somewhere for you, I'm preparing a place for you. It's even interesting, the idea about the word place, because what's behind the idea of place is almost like it's there's existing things there, and there's this special place within that place. It's almost like he's promising to the disciples there's even a specialer place for you. Maybe it's the apostle suites. I have no idea what it is, you know. But there's an intentionality to what Jesus is saying about making this place. But what the promise that comes back to is this idea that I'm going to receive you to myself. And the idea behind this word is showing a real strong sense of personal initiative to take with oneself, to join oneself to another. It's kind of the idea of being betrothed to somebody, that Jesus says, I'm going to come and receive you to me. I'm not just going to say, hey, here's the place. Enjoy the place. Here's the keys to your room. The tennis court's open till 10. Here's all the stuff you get to do. He says, I'm going to receive you to me. And what's the purpose for that? And the simple purpose is so that you will get to be with me. That where I am, there you may be also. And there's an emphasis here that's really, really interesting. It says literally where I am, it means I am. The emphasis is that, Peter, you're going to get to be with me. Remember how Peter was so concerned about, why are you leaving? I can't tolerate the thought of you leaving. He's reassuring him, Peter, you're going to be with me. That where I am, you're going to be. When I'm here, you're here. We're going to be together, Peter. And it's such this beautiful picture of how he's ready for us. You know, I just learned the news about Susan this morning. I think about Emily. I think about others. And it wasn't like, hey, you die and you wake up in some big bright room and you wait for something. Or Jesus is right there. And he's welcoming. He's there to receive Susan and Emily and us to himself, right to himself. He's saying, welcome home. This is what you've been designed for. This is what you've been made for. This is what you've been longing for, to place, to be with your Creator, to have no pain, to have no suffering, to have no struggles, to have no doubts, to have no fears, no worries, no needs, no nothing. But to be here and experience a relationship with your Creator the way you were designed to be. Welcome home. See, to Peter, the source of his agitation was not, will heaven be fun? Or will it be cool? Or will it be amazing? The question Peter had is, will I be with you? Because that's what was most important to Peter. Well, I have some thoughts that I just want to have us think about as we kind of close things up. I just want to summarize some of the assurances Jesus has given Peter, the disciples, and us in this passage. In verse 36, he says, you're going to follow me. You will come. It's just a matter of time. It's not right now, but you're going to come. He assures them of that. And verse 1 of chapter 14 says, don't be troubled about his absence, but believe. He's encouraging us and assuring us. Verse 2, he says, he's got a place in his Father's house and is prepared just for us. Underline us. Again, in verse 2, it says integrity. We didn't touch on this. He says, if there wasn't a place or a space, I would tell you about this. Jesus isn't lying. He's not stringing along a story. He's not trying to win points to get people to like him by telling them stuff that's not true. He's a man of integrity. He says, if this wasn't true, I would tell you. We've got the assurance of his own integrity. Verse 3, he says he's coming back to get us. It's this intentional, I'm coming back for you. And lastly, that when I get you, you're going to always be with me. You will always be with me. Well, let me just throw out some thoughts. First is, how are you doing in just believing this? I want to encourage you to let go of your doubt. If you're here and you have any doubt about, have you lived the right enough life? Have you fulfilled all your promises? Have you done all the right things? Have you cleaned up your act enough? Have you changed enough? Have you proven yourself enough to be worthy of God's love and kindness? That's not what it's about. That's not about it at all. It's about the promise that Jesus has made that you can't fix yourself. You can't make yourself right before God, but I can. And do you want me to apply my death for you? And if you're here this morning and you don't know that, if you haven't applied his death for you, if you haven't started a personal relationship with Christ by asking him to apply his death on the cross for your sins, I want to encourage you to do that. Because that doubt will go away. Because the promise is based on his ability to take you home, not your ability to earn the right to go home. So don't doubt. Next, stop your agitating heart. Is there some stuff that you're just agitated over? Are there things that are bouncing around in your head? Is there stuff that you can't let go of? that's hitting you from the outside, and then you kind of play with it for a while, and then you try to let it go and you can't? Trust the Lord to stop that. And what's interesting is Jesus doesn't say that simply, like, oh, just stop it. Just stop it. That's not what I'm trying to convey here. What he's saying is to believe. So what I would say is to stop agitating and start believing. Put some good theology in your head. Read your Bible. Meditate on those promises. Rehearse the gospel of how true it is. It makes me so sad when I'll talk with a young person who's gotten involved sexually before they get married, and to see the guilt in their life and the shame in their life and the pain in their life, and to hear them think about how God thinks of them, how disappointed God is in them, how on the shelf they are for him. It's like, girlfriend, that is bad theology. That is so wrong. If you know Christ, you're completely forgiven of that. You got to keep walking with him. You got to continue to believe in him. And he's going to lead you to help you to grow, how to grow in your life and develop boundaries in your life. But you've got to believe the right things. Stop being troubled by putting the wrong information in your head, but believe the right things. Well, lastly, is cultivate your affections for Jesus. How does he show up more and more in your life? How can your love for him grow daily? How do you cultivate more dependence on him? You see, the thing that just irritated Peter was the idea of Jesus leaving. How much would that bother you or me if he left our life? Let that be just a way of us to think about, man, how much do I really depend on him? How much do I really talk to him? How much am I really affectionate towards him? How much do I really share my heart and get vulnerable with him? What are the kinds of things that he must come through for me on? Well, one of the things that's going to happen this summer, I hope and I think, is that college is over for a little while. And we're going to have our college student come back. And I know she's got to work. And I know she's got to make lots of money. And I know she wants to see all of her friends. And mom and dad are going to be low on the priority list. She's going to want to borrow the car all the time. She probably won't offer to fill it with gas either. But the thing that's going to be so cool about this summer, especially as these years are starting to get thinner and thinner and thinner of our children, is that our daughter's going to come home. And that she's going to be with us for a while. And we want to enjoy every moment of that. And every time she comes back from an errand or from something else, I want to be there to say, welcome home. Because that's what God is saying to us. I've got a place for you. And I know you hate waiting. But cultivate your affection with me while you wait. Believe these things while you wait. Because when you die, and you will, I'll be there to say, welcome home. Let's pray. Jesus, I'm so grateful for just your integrity, your promise, your understanding of our life. I'm exactly like Peter. I make promises I can't fulfill. I say things that I don't know if I fully mean or if I fully understand the implications of what I say sometimes. And you know that. And you see right through it to a heart that's fickle, to a heart that's selfish, to a heart that's prideful. But I'm so grateful that my place in heaven is not based on my ability to earn it or to show you something, but because of your mercy and your grace in dying for me. And I pray for all of us here that you would remind us of that beautiful truth, that you have gone to prepare a place for us and that you are coming for us, that you will receive us. And until then, Jesus, will you help us be patient? Will you help us cultivate that love for you, that fascination of you, that sense of dependence on you that just makes your appearing sweeter and sweeter to us. In your name we pray. Amen.